A local transgender teen files a federal lawsuit. Good news for Duval County schools when it comes to their annual grades, but two middle schools are in trouble. And Congressman John Rutherford comes out against seismic testing in the Atlantic, some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9, also never miss a show. Download the WJCT app, listen to us there anytime, or on iTunes, or stream us live right now on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, Florida teachers weigh in on the future of education in the state. Plus, Jacksonville's Bosnian community remembers the 1992 genocide with a special event. We'll tell you about it, all of that ahead. But first, it's Friday, and time for our weekly roundtable as we welcome Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good morning.
Good to see you. Charles Griggs of the Jacksonville Free Press.
Good morning.
And our own national award-winning reporter, Lindsay Kilbride.
Good morning.
Guys, thanks so much for being here on the eve of this long holiday weekend. I know so many people just want to get out of the office. I frankly feel the same way. So it's good to have you all with us before we get through the end of the week. Lots to discuss this Friday. Everything from the threat of local schools closing to new money in Jacksonville for opioid addiction and the historic downtown Laura Street Trio and more. But our top story this Friday, did you hear about this case? A 16-year-old transgender student is suing the St. John's County School System, charging discrimination. Drew Adams, who will be a junior at Nice High School this fall, says he was told he would have to use one of the school's he would not be allowed to use one of the school's gender-neutral restrooms instead of the boys' bathroom, even though that is what matches his gender identity. Now, there are only a few gender-neutral bathrooms on campus, and Adams says that makes it difficult to use the restroom and get to his next class on time. Drew's mother, Erica Casper, says she thought this issue had been resolved last year when former President Barack Obama directed the nation's public schools to let students use the restrooms that correspond with their gender identities. The administration said the guidelines were derived from the federal Title IX law prohibiting schools and education programs that receive federal funding from discriminating on the basis of gender. Those guidelines, however, were revoked by President Donald Trump less than a year later. So we begin the hour by asking our callers this question. What's your reaction to the federal lawsuit just filed over transgender bathroom rights at Nice High School in St. John's County? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or weigh in on Facebook. And I mangled that lead in a little bit, Lindsay. You're our education reporter. Drew Adams says he's being told he must use a gender-neutral restroom instead of the boys' bathroom. He wants to use the boys' bathroom,
sure.
Correct?
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, this is going to be something just for the court to decide. I mean, people think that Obama's, or the, you know, is the federal government, the Department of Education joined with another department last year that sent down that interpretation, but that's what it was. It was just an interpretation saying to be, you know, if you don't want, you know, to lose this lawsuit, this is how, you know, we think it's interpreted. And Trump revoking that, none of that is really a binding change, you know what I mean? So really, we'll just have to see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Federal lawsuit, the first one that I'm aware of, Tim Gibbons, Charles Griggs, that's been filed in this area over something involving this.
It seemed like this would be sort of a catalyst for conversation around what, you know, could be best, you know, the best outcome for all. And I think that's, you know, like, you know, this is an opportunity for people to kind of look at the merits of the lawsuit and say, we can fix this internally or district-wide. Otherwise, you're going to continue to see these types of lawsuits in the future.
Yeah.
What I find interesting is, and Lindsay might actually know the details on this more, but if I recall correctly, the Duval County School District has for years basically let people use the restrooms and that conform to their gender identity.
Yeah.
There hasn't been an issue. Actually, I don't think most people even knew that until the superintendent mentioned it at one point when all of this furor was going on. Yeah, it's just been something happening in Duval County. It's going along, and there hasn't been any problems. So it's interesting to see this come up, particularly because St. John's County is, has a very well-regarded school district that, this would be an issue coming up there is interesting.
It's 549-2937, and here's a quote from the student, Drew Adams. He says, "The school system has made it abundantly clear that I am not worthy of an equal education or equal opportunities. That's pretty embarrassing, humiliating, and isolating." Drew and his mother tell media outlets it was only after the St. John's County school system failed to change the policy on this that they decided to file a lawsuit in federal court, saying his constitutional right to equal protection under the 14th Amendment is being violated and that the school board is violating Title IX. Their attorney's asking the judge for a temporary injunction so that this student can use the boys' bathroom when classes start back in several weeks. Lindsay.
Yeah, and going off of what Tim said about Duval County, I know that Nikolai Vitti was the superintendent at the time when this was really in the media, and there were lots of people coming to school board meetings because at the time, a school board member, Jason Fisher, who's now a state representative, he was calling for a common sense policy, is what he was calling it, to make sure that students would only use the restrooms of the gender or of their by the gender or
that they
the
were,
sex
born,
they were
with.
Born as.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I guess you would argue they were born the gender they identify with. So I guess it would be their sex. But anyway, so I guess at the time, Vitti was also saying that some students preferred using a gender neutral bathroom. They would provide that as well, but they would also allow students to use the one they identified with. The student clearly wants to use the bathroom they identify with. Apparently he had been doing that before. So I don't, know really what happened. I think it was an anonymous complaint or something. But yeah, like I said, this is definitely going to be an example, to show like how is Title IX going to be interpreted.
Yeah, this could set a precedent, maybe, depending on how it shakes out in court.
Yeah, it looks like once the order was revoked by President Trump, then the school decided to take some type of different action. And, that's maybe what put them in a position. But again, this is an opportunity. This is not going to be the end. We're going to see more lawsuits like this down the road because, this is so ambiguous.
It's a divisive issue, too. I'm sure we'll get some calls in a moment.
I always find interesting when something like this has been just going along. There's no issue, kids using the bathroom that, kid wants to use, and then somebody complains, there's some discussion that people start thinking about it differently, and suddenly something that had been the status quo is like, whoa, that can't happen. Whether or not there's an actual problem, without actually weighing in on the legal merits, I do find it interesting having a kid in school where this might sound like a minor issue, but it seems like the time between classes is way shorter than when I was a kid. And those kids are running from class to class.
They are.
And the idea that, you're at point A and point B and point C is over there and,
Not only that, I think that this whole bathroom debate in this country is so divisive because it, for a lot of Americans, it seems to have just cropped up very suddenly, even though the transgender community has been mobilizing and pushing on these issues for many years. It's only in the last few years that average Americans have even heard about this. Transgender issues are still really poorly understood by most Americans, I think. And so this is a lot, I think, for more conservative parents and educators to try to get their head around. There's still, I still don't think there's a full understanding of the issues that are presenting in the transgender community.
It's really interesting because when you say that, and maybe this is me misremembering, but when bathrooms were a huge deal this time around when we passed the human rights ordinance, the city did. But before that, the first and the second time, I don't recall bathrooms being such a focus of public comment. I really don't. But this last time, it was very prevalent. Like every other person that was who was against expanding the human rights ordinance, which is what protects people in the community under the basis of race, religion, all those kinds of things. They wanted to add sexual orientation, gender identity, and the T was the sticking
It became the bathroom issue became ground zero for the debate when it became a talking point. Mm-hmm. You know, as the progress was being made along the human rights ordinance.
Having covered those first two, attempts with the HRO, my memory is the same, and I think it was after North Carolina where, yeah.
Right.
And in some ways, it's because the. Opponents of that sort of thing had to move from "I don't like it; it's against my religious convictions." It just feels wrong.
Yeah.
That's not a winning argument to people who are on the fence. But saying, you know, if you do this, this bad thing will happen. If people believe that argument, at least you have something. I think the other thing is, I'm sure there are different studies, but it's something like what, half of 1% of the population identifies as transgender. So the idea that there are swarms of people who want to use a bathroom different from the gender they were identified at birth, there's not, I'm sure in the entire school district, you're talking just a handful of kids who identify as transgender, and then even of that, just a smaller bit that this becomes an issue.
Yeah, so, like you mentioned earlier, it just wasn't that big of a deal until somebody made it a big deal.
Yeah.
Lots of calls. Let's go to your thoughts and comments. 549-2937. Susan is in Mandarin. Hi, Susan.
Hi, if I understood you correctly, Jason Fisher's position, if I understood what you said about his position, he sounds very unloving. He sounds very unloving in his position, and I think it's very brave of this student to take it to court, but at the same time, I think it's sad that people have to take things to court. We need to start electing representatives that are more loving and want to represent all of us, especially the most vulnerable. So if I misunderstood Jason Fisher's position, you could clarify. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Susan. Lindsay Kilbride.
Jason Fisher, he is no longer on the school board, but he was last year. Now he's a state representative for the Mandarin area. And at the time when this was in the news and bathroom, people were challenging this. The Obama administration sent out the directive. At that time, he proposed that the school board have a policy, which he called a common sense policy, where children would be required to use the restroom of the sex that they were born as. That never was actually ever talked about or implemented in any way. Like, they never actually discussed it as a board.
Yeah. And as Tim pointed out, under Nikolai Vitti, the former superintendent, kids have for several years in Duval have just been allowed to use the bathroom they feel most comfortable using.
Right.
Correct?
And if one were a cynic, one might say that somebody would propose a policy like that when they're on the school board because they are then planning to run for...
That would be a very cynical take, Tim.
Maybe a caller or somebody.
Stephanie on the South Side. Hi, Stephanie. Good morning.
Good morning. My concern is about potential sexual assault. So if you have a born male who is, wanting to use a female bathroom, or the worst side to me is the maybe a feminine male who is now identifying as female wanting to use I worry about sexual assault. A born female using a male bathroom is opening her, himself, up to sexual assault. It just worries me. So that's all I want to say.
Thanks, Stephanie. And that came up during the debate over the updating of the human rights ordinance in Jacksonville, this idea that men would assault young girls in bathrooms.
That's
come up all over the country. Yeah. And let me just let Stephanie know, there are no instances of that anywhere that an ordinance, a city or a school has changed this policy. It's simply a red herring.
I think the caller also brought up the other side of that.
Yeah.
And this is fascinating. So the idea of saying that a person identified as female at birth who has transitioned to male, who's now using the male bathroom, that he could be assaulted as an effeminate male in the male bathroom. I always find that type of argument interesting because that I could actually see potentially happening, sure, but we should stop sexual assault. The idea of saying that the person can't use the bathroom that fits their gender identity because they might get assaulted, it basically gives a total pass to the people doing the assaulting, which is not exactly, I think, how we want to do our laws.
Yeah, I think the caller makes an interesting point is around perception, because the perception is that this will occur when there's no actual evidence of it actually occurring. So, therefore, it actually turned into another talking point for the opposition for HRO is that these things could happen when there's no evidence of it actually happening in the first place. So that
But that is an argument that's come up again and again, this because people feel vulnerable in bathrooms. And by the way, so do transgender people. Yeah. So I think that's why we see this argument come up so often.
Yeah, I think, those of us who use public restrooms know how to use public restrooms pretty much, right? If we're going to create, a problem through perception, then we're almost inviting that problem to occur.
And when it comes to the issue of the transgender community in this country, I'm quoting here from WebMD, the Williams Institute estimates there are about 700,000 people living publicly as transgender in the U.S. Those are publicly identified. Some transgender individuals say they are the opposite sex of what they were assigned at birth. Some are gender nonconforming. And clinical psychologists who specialize in these issues say that the reason that culturally this is so difficult for people is that we've been raised all our lives to think of gender as binary, he and she, when in reality, for a small percentage of people, gender exists on a continuum. There's a lot of fluidity to their identity. I hope that explains this a little bit. Let's go to Jimmy in Callahan. Jimmy, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
My problem is what's to stop now the guys from saying they would like to use the girls' bathroom? And if you don't have a male genitalia, what are you doing in a boys' bathroom to begin with? Have you ever used a boys' restroom? It's nasty at school. They don't aim correctly. There's nothing to stop a guy from just being mean to a girl in the boys' bathroom.
Thanks for the call, and I think that's what you just addressed a minute ago, Tim.
Yeah, right, with the idea that I would like to think that we have a school system that could prevent bullying, whatever your gender identity, whatever, that if you're being bullied in the bathroom, there's an issue totally apart from this conversation.
There's an email coming in from Henry, by the way. He writes, if someone wants to go in and cause harm to either gender of child, they're already going to be breaking the law. It's ridiculous to think that they would say, oh, I can't go in there because it's against the law.
Which is one of the things I think that came up in the HRO sort of conversations about this is we go down this path of having a discussion about, well, who should use what bathroom, as though we're checking that now, as though when you walk into a bathroom, if you go to any store, you go to any school, you can walk into the bathroom. I'm sure all of us have at some point in their life accidentally entered the wrong bathroom and went, holy crap, I'm in the wrong bathroom. and then you leave and you go to the right one. But so the idea that if a man wants to walk into a woman's bathroom, he can do that. And it doesn't happen now. The idea that if he then went in and assaulted somebody, he'd go, no, wait, I'm transgender. That's not like, oh, whoop, that's your excuse. Yeah. That's not how the world works.
Hank emails the show, it's already against the law for men to harass or molest women or girls in the ladies' room, whether or not they are dressed like a woman. good point from him. It's already against the law. But Charles, I know you want to comment on that, but first let's go to Stacy in Orange Park. Hi, Stacy. Good morning.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to comment that I know you guys talked that there's a lot of misinformation or misunderstanding about being transgender, and it seems that some of your panelists, with all due respect, are confused about it as well, that there's a difference between your biological sex of what you're born as and gender. Gender is a construct. Gender right. is something that we have created.
Yes.
I know you talked about it being on a continuum, on a spectrum, but that's where I think a lot of people conflate biological sex and gender identity, and where a lot of this comes into play, where it becomes almost insulting that if you identify as a different gender, that you are somehow a predator, that because you, and people are just trying to go to the bathroom. I just think it's almost silly how big of an issue this has become, and that people think that if you let people that identify as male or female into a bathroom that doesn't match their biological sex, that people are going to be hurt by it. That's insulting to say that a transgender person is essentially, a predator. And like your commenter said, if somebody's a predator, then they're going to attack someone regardless of whether or not they're allowed in a particular bathroom. It's just, I don't know, the whole discussion is just, frankly, it seems silly. And I think a lot of it just comes from ignorance that people don't understand, so they're inherently afraid of it. And that it is a question of educating people and making them understand that letting someone be who they are and go into the bathroom, especially a high school student.
Yeah, thanks, Stacey.
You know, one of your comments. Sure.
Yeah, thanks for that. And she's right. There is a lot of education that needs to take place around this issue. Here are a few tweets for you, Charles. Nicole tweets the show. This is not about what bathroom they want to use. It's about how they exist as a human being in this world. Shauna, why is no one talking about intersex people? They are biologically not binary and not as uncommon as people think. Bill tweets the show, St. John's County has A ratings, but at least in Duval, students can use their own damn bathroom. Ooh. All right. Go ahead, Charles.
That's the slogan of the Duval County School Board.
I was just going to say, yeah, I agree with the caller 100%. I mean, this is about, you know, wanting to use the restroom, for crying out loud. I mean, how hard can that be? I can't tell you how many times I've attempted to enter a men's room and a female was coming out because the female restroom was full.
I'm getting tweets about that too. Here's another tweet. How many times have we women seen the line at our bathroom been too long and we go into the unoccupied men's restroom?
Am I supposed to call the police after
that? So there's the entire movement to have basically all, you know, gender-neutral bathrooms. I always find it interesting in...
We still don't have potty parity in big places like football stadiums and stuff.
I'm not going to even address that.
But I am, Tim Gibbons.
Potty parity.
Yes, that's a real thing.
See, I was trying to fascinate...
You need more facilities for women than for men.
That. Well, see, the problem
but women
is
don't watch football, do they?
Tim, I'm going to... It's a good thing you're all the way across the table.
I find it interesting when you go to a restaurant, say, and there's two, you know, single use restrooms, and one is marked male and one is marked female. I have been in the situation where, you know, there's a 4-person line for the men's room and nobody's using the 1-person ladies' room, and I sit there going, like, it would feel weird to walk in there, but why? Just because the door says it's the ladies' room,
If it were an emergency, someone would. Absolutely.
You know, all right. One more call. Yeah. Nikki in Jacksonville Beach. Hi, Nikki.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Doing? This is a great topic. Hi.
Go ahead.
Previous caller about the concept that automatically we assume that they're a predator if someone identifies differently. I think that needs to stop. And also, as a mom of a boy, I'm really insulted that people believe that boys will automatically sexually harass people if somehow that's what laws are enacting. That's ridiculous.
All right. Thanks, Nikki. And thanks for all the calls on this. We do want to move on and talk about a few other news and notes from the week. Speaking of our schools, good news for Duval County. School grades came out this week, and 90% of Duval County public schools earned an A, B, or C grade. That's up from 75% the year before. The district has a B average for the third year in a row. However, Matthew Gilbert and Northwest Middle Schools ranked as D schools. Now, that makes them eligible to be closed under the recently passed and controversial Schools of Hope law here in Florida. Our education reporter, Lindsay Kilbride, has more about this. What does this mean for these two schools? Are they going to close?
Okay, so eligible is true. However, the school district is very confident they won't be closed. So the reason being is that the state hasn't really handed down any direction to the districts yet, and the schools did improve a lot. So Gilbert and Northwestern gained 37 and 40 points, and they're both under, you know, less than 10 points from a C. So they improved a lot, although they didn't technically make the D. Now, Rebalt was also one of those middle schools. So if you had read any of the, you know, Schools of Hope stories, this bill ended up being like a 300-page bill. This charter Schools of Hope section, which is a small portion of it, however, has big implications for school districts, especially, you know, ones that have areas of town with low-performing schools. And, you know, a lot of ours are these underutilized schools on the north and west side. And these three middle schools are all within, you know, a few miles of each other, all, you know. And so basically what the law does is it gives schools less time to improve from a F and a D to a C before the state intervenes and closes down. And so the state's always intervened and given them options to turn around. This gives them fewer turnaround options, and then it gives them less time to make the turnaround. So, you know, Matthew Gilbert and Northwestern were two of those ones. They've had, you know, Fs and Ds for, you know, 4 years or so. So they're, you know, past due, basically.
Charles.
So,
go ahead.
No, well, just to sum up really quick. So basically, when they're closed, that means that the students have to be rerouted to other schools. That also means that charter schools are incentivized to come into those areas within 5 miles of the schools. They don't have to, but that's an option. So it's been called like a charter school bill. But the thing is that, you know, the district doesn't really know what's going to happen. They're very confident that they'll be able to ask the state to keep doing what they're doing because it seems to be improving the schools, although they didn't technically make the C.
Mm-hmm. So I think the bigger question here is how the schools are rated based upon the scores they've had previously, because this is only the second year that the standards have been consistent with the previous year. So if you recall back in 2014-15, that school year, they sort of moved the goal line on the schools across the state. And so the scores, the grades they got then are really sort of insignificant to where they are now. It's hard to compare them because the standards were different. So I think in reality, what we probably need to be looking at and asking the question of policymakers is it, you know, when will we have enough time to know that these scores actually matter, these grades actually matter, and build some consistency in how they are applying the grading system across the board?
That, yeah, exactly. Like the complaint that the goalposts have been moved so often.
Yes.
Tim.
And that particularly comes into play when you look at a situation like this where there has been substantial improvement, although it's not to the level that it needs to be. You know, you're looking at trend lines more than the actual point they're at. If you're saying this is now the standard, you got to give it time to try to meet that standard. And if a school is moving in the right direction, I think the district has a good argument that, you know, you've just made this change. Give us one more year.
Yeah. I think one of the data points that you can sort of look at is a telling story is a dramatic increase across the state. And so what that says is that, you know, this is the first time that folks have had a chance to, you know, kind of concentrate on what they're supposed to do and do something about it. So,
okay, another big story from the week. Congressman John Rutherford is helping lead an effort against seismic testing in the Atlantic Ocean. Rutherford says the air gun blasting could be damaging to coastal businesses that rely on a healthy ocean. Now, the Trump administration is reviewing applications by 5 energy companies who want to explore oil in the Atlantic. However, Rutherford and more than 100 other members of Congress signed a letter to the Secretary of Interior explaining their opposition to this blasting. Congressman Rutherford saying that seismic testing would threaten our fragile coastal economies and fisheries. The environmental group Oceana is applauding this letter. So an unlikely alliance, perhaps, by environmental groups and our conservative congressman on this issue.
Whatever happened to drill, baby, drill?
Not when it comes to the ocean.
We're going
to
care about the environment rather than getting more oil? That seems un-American.
Lindsay.
But it has a business tie. So instead of going for that, it disrupts whale breeding, it's that disrupts these fisheries in Northeast Florida that really rely on healthy oceans. So, I mean, you know, that's a way for a conservative person who, you know, wants to take the business approach, you know, can support something like
that. There is a really good argument there. That was the winning bit of going from, you know, basically a bunch of hippies just, you're just anti-drilling, to also the tourism side of, you know, if you do this.
Then don't want oil on the beach.
Right. That you have people who, they want to care about the environment. They care very much about, you know, vacation rentals.
Okay. Two more news and notes from the week. The Jacksonville City Council held its big investiture last night with new President Anna Broche sworn in for the next year. On Tuesday, the council approved a bill to spend $1.4 million on a new pilot program to fight the opioid epidemic and $10 million to help renovate the long empty Laura Street trio of historic buildings in downtown Jacksonville. So those caught our eye this week. And finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre.
Those happened.
And, just a few $1 million.
And we're a little tight on time, or we could explore them at greater length. But finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week. Luckily, there's never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now. Only in Florida, the transportation edition. We have stories of Florida madness on both land and sea today. First, the sea. Only in Florida does a pilotless boat chug unmanned right onto the beach. Police in Daytona Beach say 20-year-old Jonathan Race stole a boat from a private marina where it was being repaired. He eventually abandoned it, and then it washed ashore with no one at the helm, barreling its way at full throttle from the ocean onto the sand, scaring beachgoers and puzzled lifeguards. Now, they found Race because he left behind some shorts on the boat with his ID in the pocket.
Of course.
He says he blacked out after drinking a couple of Four Locos at a 7-Eleven across the street, and he just couldn't remember what happened. All he knows is that he woke up on the beach about 2 miles south of where the boat came ashore. Race tells police he was also puzzled to find himself wearing a pair of blue shorts that did not belong to him.
Charles probably knows way more about this than I do, but is this what they mean by autonomous vehicles?
Yes, yes. Video surveillance does show Race stealing a 36-foot Northern Way vessel named the Ethel Jean. He is charged with 2 counts of burglary of an unoccupied structure, conveyance, and grand theft of a vehicle. Less than $100,000. The boat is a vehicle. That's right.
Wait, so where did the shorts come from?
Okay, this one's my other favorite of the week. Only in Florida does a golf cart riding, wine swilling granny in the Villages get arrested for taking her cart on a wild spree. 62-year-old Joyce Hellcamp Smith was collared by the cops Tuesday after her madcap ride in the golf cart in the Village of St. Charles. Police say her golf cart was hitting curbs, driving in and out of lanes, and going right in front of oncoming traffic. It finally came to a stop in someone's yard. Now, Ms. Smith admitted she had consumed a little wine, and the deputy did spot a cardboard 1-liter wine container inside the golf cart. You gotta love boxed wine. Now, she told the deputy she lived around the corner and just wanted to go home. "Do we have to do this?" she asked. Yes, they did. Mrs. Smith was arrested on a charge of driving under the influence.
This happens more than you think.
And I hear tell that at the Villages, these types of stories are actually quite common. But
that actually might be my retirement plan.
We have someone who works here whose father lives at the Villages.
That's right. Our own serene and majestic Michelle Corum. Is he going to ask Mrs. Smith out on a date? Because she sounds like a good time, you know, might be a fun date. Michelle's not answering me. She's too dignified. Thank you, Lindsay Kilbride, Charles Griggs, and Tim Gibbons. And by the way, have a great holiday weekend.
Same to you.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
When it's time for a summer treat, I scream, you scream, we all scream for one thing.
We've been eating ice cream since the beginning of the country, starting with George Washington. He had an absolute love for ice cream.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, a sweet and tasty deep dive next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I decided to close the door on gambling, blackjack, poker. It didn't matter what form, that part of my life was now over. I fell in love and I moved to Seattle to be with this woman. And, you know, Seattle is a little bit different from New York, the city. It is a city where nobody is trying to accomplish anything.
Join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour. True stories told live from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. Saturdays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, thousands of educators from all 50 states are in Boston this week to talk about the most pressing issues facing students, schools, and the teaching profession. It's the National Education Association's 155th annual meeting. Now, the group includes a big cohort of teachers from Florida, and they're speaking out. Joanna McCall is president of the Florida Education Association, and she's on the line. Joanna, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And lots of issues on the table this week at the big confab, but what are the issues that Florida teachers are most concerned about?
So there's a couple of things. The NEA undertook this big topic called institutional racism. And so the FEA has really embraced that, and we actually have started to do conferences and trainings all across the state, because even though it's 2017 and we should be more progressive and not treating people the way that we do, it seems that lately we have gone back into that. And so that's a very important thing for us. We want to use our collective voice to bring a light and demand that changes happen to the policies and programs so that we are not having institutional racism and everybody is created equal as the Constitution says. So that's one thing that's going to be important to us. We probably also will have some discussion about vouchers centered around the new Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, because she thinks that Florida should be the model for the rest of the country. So we'll be talking about that. And then there are two policies, one on charter schools and one on digital learning. I think those will be hot topics for the delegates in Florida as well, because we have so many charters, and then our virtual school system has had an explosion.
Wow, yeah, the charter issue, the virtual school issue in Florida, how Florida can be a model for vouchers. What's the Florida Education Association's position on the voucher issue, for example?
So the message from Florida is the voucher system doesn't work in our opinion, and it has created a parallel system in Florida. We are very unique that we have some very strong language in our Constitution that our Florida legislatures seem to ignore. We know that we educate 90% of the students. 2.8 million students go to traditional public schools. 256,000 go to charter schools in the state, and we know about 70,000 go to voucher schools. If we were able to compare traditional public schools with charters and voucher schools, you would see that I believe the traditional public schools do much better. But because of the loopholes and how they report and that they don't have to do the same types of things, you can't compare apples to oranges. And so that's where the big debate comes. I believe we do a great job with our traditional public schools, and we just need to make sure that our voices are heard about that.
And what's the message you have for the state's elected officials? What's the biggest issue that your educators are talking to you about?
So currently, the piece that just came out of this last legislative session, House Bill 7069, is what has a lot of my teachers and support staff, and not just my members upset, but superintendents, school boards, and parents are upset about the passage of House Bill 7069. It has a detrimental effect to our traditional public schools, and that is the message we're going to send loud and clear to our lawmakers as we move into committee weeks in September, as into the session in January, and as we move into the election cycle in 2018. Our members are going to stay engaged, and they're going to stay angry, and we are going to make sure that our voices are heard at the ballot box in 2018.
There's been a lot of discussion about where public education needs to go in Florida. What are the things that you're happy about? What's the good news?
Well, what I'm happy about is that no matter what the Florida legislature does or doesn't do, our teachers and support staff and those that teach our children are teaching our children, and that's evident by the school grades that just came out. If you look at the school grades, 57% of our schools earned an A or B, and the number of F schools went down from 111 to 43. That's a direct result of our teachers and our educational staff professionals and our principals doing the job in spite of whatever the Florida legislature says. So I'm proud of that, and I'm proud of their resolve to do what's right for students across the state.
Joanna McCall is president of the Florida Education Association. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
You too, and we'll be right back.
We spend billions to protect our nuclear arsenal, but what about the people doing the protecting? I'm Ira Flatto on the next Science Friday, how safety and security are being compromised at nuclear weapons labs. Plus, we hop a flight with a researcher scouting polar bears.
You have one chance to get out and see the bears every year and find out how they're doing.
It's all on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT. folk, blues, jazz, R&B, country, western, Americana. It's all acoustic and it's all in one place. And that one place is String Theory. And you can hear String Theory Friday nights at 11 p.m. only on 89.9 WJCT. String Theory, the very best of modern acoustic music. This and every Friday night at 11 p.m. on WJCT.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele inviting you to tune in this weekend for a Prairie Home Companion from Philadelphia. Our lineup of guests includes the world-renowned singer Angelique Kidjo, Mr. Jason Isbell, the Dover Quartet, and one of our very favorite poets, Billy Collins. Plus a bit of comedy from the Royal Academy of Radio Actors, my song of the week, and a whole lot more from the City of Brotherly Love. Hope you'll join us.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WGCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, in April of 1992, the government of the Yugoslav Republic of Bosnia-Herzegovina declared its independence from Yugoslavia. Over the next several years, Bosnian Serb forces, with the backing of the Serb-dominated Yugoslav army, targeted both Bosnian Muslim and Croatian civilians, with atrocious crimes resulting in the deaths of some 100,000 people. It was the worst act of genocide since the Nazi regime's destruction of some 6 million European Jews during World War II. Now, tomorrow, a special event takes place at Friendship Fountain in downtown Jacksonville to bring awareness of the Bosnian genocide. The local Bosnian community has organized this. Fuata Velik is the program coordinator and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. And when you approached me about this, I was interested because I didn't know there was a, first of all, I didn't know there was a local Bosnian American community in Jacksonville. So that's number one. How big is the community here?
The community, it's very big. We have about 25,000 of Bosnians in Jacksonville.
Wow. And so you'll have an event this weekend. More about that in a moment. But first, let's go back to 1992. Memories of what happened in Bosnia have perhaps become hazy for many listeners. Let's refresh everyone's memory about what went on during those years in that part of Europe.
In 1992, it started war in Bosnia, where actually escalated to genocide. In 1995, Srebrenica was occupied, and over 8,000 people were killed, and that's mainly men and boys. And also 23,000 of ladies and girls were raped and prosecuted.
Yeah. 100,000 eventually died. The biggest genocide since World War II.
Yes.
Yeah. What was your family story like during these years?
At that time, I was 8, and that's the last time when I saw my dad, and that's the last time when I saw my brother.
You lost your dad and your brother.
Yes. My brother actually was in woods hiding, and years later on, he flew in city where we actually were prosecuted.
You were prosecuted?
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yes. During the genocide or war in Bosnia, they will take ladies and girls to the street, and they will just rape on front of us ladies, and they will say we are safe, and they will take us to Freedom City. In the meantime, they will still do raping and torturing. And they put us in camp, and we did not have food nor any medical treatments or anything. So it's been...
It was a concentration camp.
Yes.
And you were placed there at the age of 8?
Yes.
How long were you there?
Till I was 16.
8 years.
8 years. And then after that, we found my brother is alive. And then he...
Where was he?
He was in Srebrenica. And we were in Tuzla, which is basically more than 42 kilometers apart. But it was in between. It was a zone where we couldn't walk nor see each other nor hear each other or anything. We did not know anything about each other.
But you eventually did find him. And how did you get free after 8 years in this camp?
War war stopped and some of the families decided they want to simply adopt us, me and my sisters and my mom, and help us out. And they found what had happened, and we don't have home. It's been taken from us and everything. And that's how we got free.
You were adopted by an American family?
No, by some Bosnian family in the Free City.
So they took you in?
Yes.
And how long were you there before your family made its way to Jacksonville, Florida?
3 years.
What prompted you to come here?
The Red Cross came to Bosnia, and they decided whoever lost homes and family members, that we can come to the United States. So we will do paperwork and medical examinations and everything, and then we got here.
And so many Bosnians have made their way to Jacksonville in much the same way you and your family
did. Yes.
And started all over again.
Yes.
It's hard, I think, for so many Americans to understand what could have led to this just brutality between two groups of people that had been living in peace for quite some time.
Right.
What would you say to those who just, they don't understand how that could have even happened?
We neither. It's just everybody were in peace. Everybody were in love. Bosnia is a country that actually every religion, culture, it's a multicultural country. And we never had any issues till 1992.
In 1992, the Serbs and the Croats, it was those two groups that divided.
Yes.
Yeah. Most Americans don't understand the difference between those two groups. Can you explain that a little?
Serbs, actually, they are the one that did genocide on Bosnia.
Yeah.
And Croatia, on another side, they were with us, but they couldn't help to Bosnia much because of some regulations.
Now, is religion the driving force that led to the genocide? That's a misnomer, isn't it? That's a myth.
Actually, no. It's mainly because of civil act, but religious, it's not. Bosnia, it's a country of freedom, and any religion, it's welcome.
And so when you think back on those times, clearly the trauma was overwhelming. It's important to, just as we did with the Holocaust, to make sure people don't forget that this occurred.
Exactly. Yes, it's been genocide. It's been recognized as a genocide, and we have to bring awareness.
And so you're doing that this weekend.
Yes.
This is the third year in a row the Bosnian community has held this event. What's going to be happening?
Every year we lay 8,000 roses. This is in remembering 8,000 people that were killed in one day in Srebrenica in 1995. Mm-hmm. It is a very sensitive moment for lots of Bosnians in Jacksonville.
You're going to be doing this Saturday morning at the Downtown Friendship Fountain.
Yes, and we will have walk. It's called Marsh Mira. We will do 1 mile walk, and we will be laying 8,000 roses.
You brought a flower pin with you.
Yes.
And you have it on your shirt. It's a white crocheted flower with a green center. What's the significance of the flower?
Yes, each petal of this flower, its meaning of Srebrenica. This flower, it's made homemade by the ladies, mothers, sisters, whoever actually felt and lost their loved ones during the Srebrenica genocide.
They wear that in memory.
Yes. Usually Bosnians wear this flower for the entire month of July.
And so if you see one of these flowers on someone around town, that's the reason why. And you invite everyone to come out to this event tomorrow morning.
Yes, everybody's welcomed. We will have some guest speakers. We will have lots of material and documents. If anybody wants to learn or have any questions, we will be there.
Well, thanks for raising awareness with us and letting us know about this. We really appreciate you being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Fuata Velik is the program coordinator for the Bosnian Observance. It's Saturday, July 1st, 9 a.m. at the Downtown Friendship Fountain. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chepchik. We love your feedback. Send your questions and comments to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And never miss a show. Download the WJCT app and listen there anytime or on iTunes. Up next on 1A, the weekly news roundup. If you missed this show, by the way, listen to the rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. Join us Monday at 9 a.m. for a special show as we take a look back at some of the celebrities who visited Studio 5 over the years. And we'll be back live Wednesday at 9 a.m. Have a safe and happy 4th of July weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.